Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Today's Friday, April 12th. Let the record reflect the time is 1:32 p.m. Today we have President Senator Michicki, Senator Keel, and myself, Chair Hughes. Please silence or turn off your cell phones. Thank you to those assisting us today. We have two items on our agenda. First, we'll take up Senate Joint Resolution 3, Constitutional Amendment, Membership of Judicial Council, sponsored by Senator Schauer. Following that, we will consider the governor's appointment to the Commission on Judicial Conduct. I'd like to ask committee members to please keep your questions and comments focused on the items before the committee. As always, concise questions, thoughtful brevity are the order of the day. At this time, I'd like to invite Senator Schauer and Mr. Scott Ogan to the table. While they make their way to the table, I'd just like to inform committee members that the following individuals are available for questions, and both are in the room: Nancy Mead with Alaska Court System and Suzanne DiPietro with Alaska Judicial Council. Mr. Ogan, welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Please place your name on the record and tell us about Senate Joint Resolution Number 3.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Scott Ogan. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor for Senator Mike Schauer.
And I'm going to say I was following the script because I didn't know you were going to be at the table. So I'm going to let the sponsor, Senator Schauer, if he would put his name on the record and allow him to introduce the bill or say what he'd like. And
Madam Chair, I am. Flexibility is the key to air power, as we used to say in a different life. I can roll however you want. So, Madam Chair, it's Senator Mike Schauer from District E. And here is the sponsor for Senate Joint Resolution Number 3. And with your permission, we'll get started.
Please.
Okay, I'll go ahead and read like we normally do for this. The bill title, as you already heard, was proposing an amendment to the Constitution of the State of Alaska relating to the membership of the Judicial Council. Alaska's Constitution, Article 1, Section 2 states, "All power is inherent with the people. All government originates with the people, is founded on their will only, and is instituted solely for the good of the people as a whole." Passage of Senate Joint Resolution 3 will help restore this aforementioned principle as noted by the Constitutional Convention's professional consultants. These sections in particular go a long way toward withdrawing the judicial branch from the control of the people of the state and placing it under that of the organized bar. The Constitutional Convention professional consultants also said, "The convention has gone farther than necessary or safe in putting them, the Judicial Council, and the hands of a private professional group, however public-spirited its members may be." Senate Joint Resolution 3 places a constitutional amendment on the next general election ballot that would allow the voters to decide whether the membership of the Alaska Judicial Council bar members should require legislative confirmation of all members. Currently, only public members are subject to legislative confirmation. Alaska is one of a handful of states that does not require legislative confirmation of a member of the bar to serve on the Judicial Council. SJR 3 would increase the public's voice on the Judicial Council through legislative confirmation of the members of the bar. Currently, the attorney members are selected by the Board of Governors of the Bar Association and are not currently subject to legislative confirmation as they are in many other states. The lack of legislative confirmation is a stark, glaring oversight when all members of every other Alaska regulatory or quasi-judicial agency are subject to confirmation according to Article 3, Section 26 of the Alaska Constitution. The sponsor of this legislation believes that the bar has too much unilateral influence on who is ultimately submitted to the governor for consideration of becoming a judge or a justice. Alaska's current crime wave requires a holistic approach in considering all aspects of the criminal justice system. In some states, judges run for popular election with the old hang 'em high judges winning by popular affirmation. This measure will still protect the integrity of judicial temperament, in my opinion, and impartiality with greater accountability by the people's representatives, looking for, as always, the balance in between. SJR will still put the Chief Justice in a perceived and sometimes actual conflict of interest. The Judicial Council must act by concurrence of four members as required by Article 4 of the Constitution. According to the Judicial Council bylaws, Article 5, Section 1, the Chief Justice normally does not vote on any matter coming before the Council except in those instances, quoting the bylaws, when to do so could change the result. Because of this provision of the bylaws, on those occasions when the six regular voting members split 3-3, the Chief Justice suddenly morphs from a non-voting member of the Council into a crucial deciding vote on whether an applicant will be forwarded to the governor or not. Inevitably, this empowers the Chief Justice to use inclusion or exclusion of an applicant as a means of influencing who will be among his or her peers on the bench. It is even more alarming when this occurs during a Supreme Court nominating vote, and in fact, These tie-breaking votes have occurred several times in recent memory for Supreme Court vacancies. SJR 3 provides a cursory level of legislative oversight to members of the bar that serve on the council. The bar having unilateral power to appoint who selects judges that the governor consider is an inherent conflict of interest to the profession and cast doubt on their objectivity with the judicial temperament and philosophy of the candidate. The tie votes on the council are especially troubling when it involves a split of all three public non-attorney members voting one way and all the attorney members voting the opposite way. They're rare over the course of the council's history. These attorney, non-attorney vote splits have happened much more frequently in the past few years. From June 22, 2012 to October 10, 2013, there were five attorney, non-attorney split votes in which all three public members voted to send an applicant's name to the governor. But the Chief Justice sided with the attorney members and turned the applicants down. I have an analogy here, Madam Chair, that I think might make more sense to some of the public as they're watching. In context of government service and the three branches of service that we have, the administrative or executive, the legislative, and the judicial, when you allow a judge to be picked from their own with no voice from the people, what this is essentially like would be like the governor getting to pick who the next governor is from a pool of governors. Legislators picking, who the next legislators would be from a pool of only legislators. And that's not something I think most people would think would be reasonable. However, in this case, we're allowing attorneys to pick who the next judges are going to be. And I've got a few more pieces of information I would like to just put out there very quickly. The Republican form of government and the merit system is an article that I wrote, and I'm just going to read a couple of highlights here. But this is old language English, and I think it's important from the Federalist Papers, James Madison, one of the founders of our country. The first question that offers itself is whether the general form and aspect of the government be strictly Republican. It is evident that no other form would be reconcilable with the genius of the American people, with the fundamental principles of the Revolution, or with that honorable determination which animates every votary of freedom to rest all our political experiments on the capacity of mankind for self-government. If the plan of convention, therefore, be found to depart from the Republican character, its advocates must abandon it as no longer defensible. He also said in Federalist 39, we may define a republic to be, or at least may bestow that name on, a government which derives all its power, directly or indirectly, from the great body of the people. It is essential to such a government that it be derived from the great body of society, not from an inconsiderable portion or a favored class of it. Even the judges, with all other officers of the union, will, as in the several states, be the choice, though a remote choice, of the people themselves. And my final commentary on this, the process outlined in the state constitution for selecting judges in Alaska, in my opinion, is not Republican as defined by Madison in Federalist 39 and guaranteed under Article 4, Section 4 of the U.S. Constitution. Alaska's judicial selection process is unrepublican. It grants power over one-third of the state's government, of our three branches of government, to judicial nominees who are not even the remote choice of the people. Instead, they are the choice of the Alaska's Bar Association, a private organization consisting of an inconsiderable proportion of the population, about 4,500 people or so, about 0.6% of the state's population. So, Madam Chair, that is the reason why we have brought forth this Senate joint resolution, to see if we can get the people's voice back into the process of selecting who ends up ultimately as our justices all the way to the Supreme Court. And I would remind everyone that we are not picking the justices themselves. We're merely asking for the voice of the people to have a voice in putting who sits on the council that then picks those. So this is just one very remote choice of the people, as I have outlined here. I'm going to stop there and answer questions and or defer to my senior policy advisor so he can go a little further in depth.
Mr. Ogun, do you have anything you want to add, including just technically kind of explaining for those that might not have the bill in front of them exactly what the proposed constitutional amendment would do?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. The constitutional amendment would simply give the legislature the ability to confirm the members of the bar that are appointed to the Judicial Council. It's a very simple amendment. The policy associated with that, again, like the Senator said, we believe that in Article 1, Section 2 of the Alaska Constitution says, we don't believe it, it does say that, all political power is inherent with the people, and all government originates with the people, is founded upon their will only, and is instituted for the good of the people as a whole. Alaska's unified court system is very efficient compared to other states. There are definite advantages to having a judiciary independent, with an independent body, free of elections, campaign donations, and those kind of things. And the framers, the Constitution, were very mindful when they made that decision to set up a merit system. And we support that philosophy. And the disadvantage is the branch of government that is supposed to provide the check and checks and balance has no corresponding checks from the citizens themselves. In contrast, many states have county courts and other jurisdictions that challenge superior court's assumptions or rulings in various cases, or at least present reasonable arguments why they should rule one way or another. And also, many other states confirm members of the bar via their legislatures, and they're not appointed by a committee. Let's see. We fully expect the Supreme Court to recuse themselves if a constitutional challenge to this measure ever comes before them, because they have they are on record I think they'll be on record soon with their court appointed spokesperson opposing the measure. That's what she told me, that they were opposed to it. Because they've shown their bias and political activism against this measure by opposing it in the political arena. So not sure how that would be sorted out. But what the bar won't tell you about constitutional convention and the founders' handiwork, the founders ignored the wisdom of the professional consultants that they hired. The bar will not tell you that the Judiciary Committee and the Constitutional Convention consisted of 5 lawyers and 2 laymen. According to the record, the purportedly fair and balanced committee quickly agreed to follow the principles suggested by the American Bar Association and their professional civic groups. They deliberately designed the Judicial Council with a weighted balance to easily prevail over the people's representatives in a close call. And committee of the day created a judicial oligarchy to empower the Alaska Bar as the sole source power of this branch of government. We find that very troubling. This constitutional committee structure reminds me of the old fable of what a real democracy is, a committee of 5 wolves and 2 lambs deciding what's for lunch. Excuse me. Vic Fisher, the last surviving constitutional founder, wrote a book, and in that book he talked about that the main feature of the proposed judicial council system was unity, simplicity, efficiency, accessibility, independence from the executive and legislative branches, and accountability to the people. Regrettably, the accountability to the people, at least in the judge selection process, got left on the table. Only a smidgen of accountability that is left to the people is when the bar-controlled council evaluates judges and tells citizens how to vote on retention during election.
Mr. Ogun, I'm going to interrupt for a minute. When you started talking about Vic Fisher, were you quoting from his book, and when did the quote start, and when did the quote end, and when did your commentary begin?
The quote is starting, the main features of the proposed judicial council system was unity, simplicity, efficiency, accessibility, independence from the executive and legislative branches, and accountability to the people. That's where the quote ended.
Okay, thank you.
And then my comments are regrettably from that point on.
Okay, and thank you. Go ahead and continue with regrettably. Just pick up there, please.
Regrettably, the accountability to the people, at least in the judge selection process, got left on the table. Only a smidgen of accountability that is left to the people when the bar-controlled council evaluates judges and tells citizens how to vote on retention during election. So that's really the only time that people have a say in this. And as, in addition, except that there is the minority of public members that are confirmed by the legislature. So there's 3 of those members that's important to keep in mind. The only time the Chief Justice weighs in is if there's a a split vote. So those are the two opportunities that the people have to be involved in the Judicial Council. But again, I'll repeat what the senator said earlier about the consultant's report, and I quote, "These sections in particular go a long way toward withdrawing the judicial branch from the control of the people of the state and placing it under that of the organized bar. No state constitution has ever gone as far by placing one of these three coordinate branches of the government beyond the reach of democratic controls. We feel that in its desire to preserve the integrity of the courts, the convention has gone farther than necessary or safe in putting them in the hands of a private professional group, however public-spirited its members may be," unquote. The sponsor of this legislation, Senator Schauer, agrees with the constitutional consultants that the convention went too far when it placed the entire judiciary branch under the control of the Alaska Bar Association. And we appreciate your support and moving this measure from committee and furthering this discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do you know what the response was to the constitutional consultants? That's a pretty strong statement. It sounds like they did not think that it went farther than necessary, was not safe. What was the response, do you know?
The response was they apparently ignored them, and one might say the five wolves at the table had the lambs for lunch.
Okay. Thank you. We have our government is, the foundation of it is a separation of powers doctrine, but part of that is the check and balances between the branches. What other check and balance does the legislature have on the judiciary branch other than the appropriation process and perhaps adjusting a court rule? Can you think of any other check and balance we have on the judiciary branch?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, the legislature at times attempts to deal with constitutional questions that the courts rule against by passing legislation. And I think a lot of the frustration is that there are those in this building, and I know the senator and I are two of them, that believe that let the Supreme Court at times legislates from the bench. So the checks and balances we have, I mean, it's an important part of our democracy, and we're not trying to undermine that. We're not trying to politicize it. I think that's the big concern, that while you're just trying to politicize who gets appointed to the bench, the Constitution bans political consideration for the Judicial Council, and that constitutional ban would apply to the legislature. If we considered folks for the Judicial Council positions, we would not be able to consider what party they are. We would just have to consider, we being the legislature, would have to consider their competency and their suitability to be on the council, and we would not be allowed to consider their politics.
I appreciate the premise upon which this is based, that all power is inherent with the people, all government originates with the people. So I appreciate that. I'm going to keep an open mind because I know we've received quite a bit of opposition. Mm-hmm. And so that check and balance is significant. And I can think, of course, that part of the check and balance would be the confirmation of the three public members on the council. And then later we'll be hearing from an appointee for the Judicial Conduct Commission. And those are all confirmed by the legislature. So there's a little check and balance. But when I think about the other directions, judiciary's check and balance on the legislature is quite high, I think, because they can actually overturn and state something that we pass as unconstitutional, and that's their job to weigh that. And so the check and balance is a thing I think that is really important in this discussion. I know the part of the opposition is that this is a merit-based system, and there's corruption in other states and a lot of politics. And sometimes when I'm in the lower 48, I'll be in a place where I see judges up for election and just signs everywhere You mentioned that other states have something similar to judicial councils. Do they all? And my impression is a lot of states is really an election process instead of what we have, and that our system is unique. Do you know how it compares with other states, Mr. Ogun?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know the exact number of states that nominate their judges to judicial council. I do know that there's a very, very small handful that do not allow the legislature to confirm the members of the bar.
Okay. Thank you. Another thing that we're hearing from opposition is, you know, it's working. It works fine. It's not broken. It doesn't need a fix. Would you agree with that, Senator Schauer?
Yeah, Madam Chair, thanks. Because I have a couple comments here. One, I actually operate under that axiom often, which is if it's not broke, don't fix it. And I think that's often some of the things we do here. But the premise, I think, when we're going back upon this is the concern is if, for example, if you look back in the historical data that I read or presented to the committee, when you have a split vote and the citizens are voting one way and the attorneys vote the other on the board or the council, and the Supreme Court justice, the chief, sides with them, and every time, I would argue perhaps maybe it's not working as intended. Now, you can make an argument that, well, that's because they just have the right data and they're making it choices based on just the merit system and nothing else, but that's a little troubling to me that when the citizens vote one way and see something, and then the Supreme Court and the lawyers that are on the other side of it vote different and deny that choice to the governor, I think perhaps that's where we're starting to run into problems. When you see it becomes, and I'm going to use the word ideological, but it may not be the best in context here, but I mean it more in context of the Bar Association, lawyers that are that very small group of our subset of the population, not of the greater population of the people. They're coming from a group that is trained the same way, often can think the same way, they have the same job duties and titles and go through all of that, so you start to get a more homogenous group. And every citizen, you could say that in the military, you could say that in the legislature, you could say that in a lot of things. While there's certainly diversification, Democrats versus Republican, for example, conservative versus liberal, that would be a human thing. And so I think one of the things that is concerning to me is that, for example, we already know there's opposition to this, and strangely, this opposition is coming from the Supreme Court itself of Alaska, in opposition to this, which I start to equate back to my military strategy. When you start to get close to a target that is really near and dear to the enemy's heart, they fight the hardest. Perhaps if I am onto something here with this resolution and they're starting to fight very hard for it, maybe there's more to the story. Now, some are probably going to shake their head at that, but my point is that if we are identifying a place that maybe could be done a little bit better and maybe would provide a little more balance to the system, and by balance I mean the representation of the people, then perhaps that's something we should be looking at, which is why we're presenting this resolution. I fully expect a full court press from the opposition. We were already getting it, strangely, but not mostly from lawyers, the Bar Association, Supreme Court itself, et cetera. And I'm sure we're going to get more of it, and I'm sure they're going to tell us why it's working fine. But I'm going to go back to the basis, Madam Chair. What this is about to me at the end of the day is we're a representative republic. The people have a voice. All power. That's not a little bit of power. That's not some of the power. All power is derived from the will of the people. And if you have one of your branches of government, a full third of it, which, by the way, as you pointed out very clearly, has almost complete power over the legislative and executive branches for laws that are passed to decide not to pass them in their interpretation, human, right? That is troubling. And the sense of the people essentially have little to no voice in that process of the members from the Bar Association, a small subset of people. That's really, Madam Chair, where I'm going with this is that is troubling that such a small group gets the ability to pick members from its own pool that go onto the bench picked by the governor that then have the ability to strike down laws and make decisions about everything we do. We certainly see members from the court in front of us at times talking about things, but I can guarantee you that the court would not be very happy if a legislator tried to bring a piece of legislation and argue it in front of them. I mean, so there's kind of a little bit of a one-way street in how that works. So that is a long answer to your short question, but like I said, Madam Chair, I'm trying to take this back to the basis of our foundation and what matters. And what drives my decision process is the will of the people and our Constitution. And I think it can be done a little bit better.
I appreciate that, and standing up for the people is important, and I can say this because this is a public meeting and because the ethics law isn't quite fixed, as a lot of people understand. I can't work privately right now on health care matters and had to withdraw a bill. And in that case, it was standing up for the people, and the healthcare industry it is not wild about that bill. The health insurance industry is not wild about that bill. But I have to step back and think, what is right for the people. So I appreciate your effort in that regard. When we're talking about something being democratic and representative, I do have to say that when I think about with kind of an in-house buddy-buddy, if we're worried about corruption, and I'm not saying the bar is corrupt, I'm not saying that, let me make that very clear, but when they're picking within their own, it really is less democratic and representative, as you've pointed out. And when you think of the three branches right now, of course, the executive branch is going to be typically one party or another. Someday we might have a third party, but it will be a party, right? The legislative branch is always going to be a mix of parties. The judiciary branch is to be nonpartisan. However, in research, I spent a couple weekends ago looking up some credible research out of universities, and the attorney profession back in the 50s and the 60s when we became a state, for example, tended to be very moderate, slightly left of center. And now, depending on which research you read, it's anywhere from 68% to 74% attorneys consider themselves on the left. And so if we're talking about balance, the legislature really can create balance. And as far as politicizing, and maybe I'm different, but I believe, and a lot of my colleagues the same, when we're voting confirmation votes, we are looking at merit. We are looking at qualifications. And so just because if this, for instance, if this were to pass, I don't think we're disregarding merit. We're looking, is that merit at a high enough place? And the pool that would be put forward for the votes would always be coming from the bar, and if merit, high merits and qualifications are the standard, every candidate that they would put before, if this were to pass, would be at a scale that they consider acceptable. So I don't think that we'd be, I believe you mentioned that you supported the concept of merit. I don't think we'd be disregarding that. Would it be politicized? The opposition seems to think it would be. For perhaps some legislators, it would be a politicized vote. But I know for myself, and I know a number of others, it would not be. So I just thought I'd wanted to get out there. And of course, as you mentioned, we confirm all the other appointees for the executive branch. We vote on the attorney general, for instance. That's an attorney that we vote on. We're going to be confirming for the, as I said earlier, Judicial Conduct Commission. So I don't believe that the merit is really removed from the process, because even if someone were voted down, the bar's next presentation for a confirmation vote would be someone of merit. So I think that's important to consider as we think about this. And I know Senator Keel's had his hand up, and thank you for your patience, Senator Keel.
I'm sure. I just make two comments before we go for Senator Keel's questions. I just want to reiterate two things on that, and you've kind of highlighted them, but I think they're very important. One, the Constitution doesn't allow us to get political in the process. We're human. Humans are going to do things. There's no way to get around it. And if somebody tries to tell me a judge is absolutely unbiased, I'm sorry, I don't believe it. You're a human being. You do your best, but we all live our life through the prism of our experiences. So human emotions and experiences matter. And it's very hard to take that out of your life. And I'm not saying people can't do it and be objective. That's not my point. But we are human beings. But I'll go back to the Constitution says we can't have that. So anybody say, well, it's going to be a political process. Well, the Constitution says that it's not. If somebody says, well, you know, if I try to say that a judge is going to have a political bias based on their own opinions, they try to say, well, they don't. Well, it either works both ways or it doesn't work at all, right? So, and the second point I want to highlight, because this is important, some people, I think, are making this sound like we're the ones picking who are going to the governor to sit on the bench. We're not. This is merely giving a balance and a very small voice of the people to those that are going to sit on the council that picks those that go to the governor to sit on the bench. And I think that's very important to highlight it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Jesse. Senator Keel. Sorry about that.
It's Friday. Friday, Madam Chair.
He's Jesse when I see him in the hall or we meet in our offices.
Turns
so sorry about that.
Same guy either way. That's fine. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate it's been a good discussion. I appreciate the discussion of the principle, because of course we can come up with examples of times when the legislature has considered folks, appointees, who are not of the same party as a majority in the legislature and either voted them down or during the joint session without a single word of debate, which I question whether that is always apolitical. We no need to rehash those examples, but I think that's happened. And so it calls into some question, I guess, the utterly apolitical and merit-based notion of the legislature. But rather than belabor that point, a couple of historical questions maybe to start. Has there been a Chief Justice who had not sat for their first retention vote?
I'm going to defer to my senior policy advisor, and we may have to get back to you. I'll guarantee there's a few questions we don't have answered to this.
Mr. Ogun?
Of Chief Justice at what? I'm sorry?
Who had not sat for their first retention vote. Every judge, justice, et cetera, within the first 3 years of sitting on the bench has to go in front of the people for a retention vote. And I just wondered if the Supreme Court had ever elected its own Chief Justice before that retention vote, a member who had not yet had that retention vote.
I'll have to get back with you. I haven't really considered that. And so don't know the answer to that question.
Okay. And Madam Chair, just for Senator Keel's question, even though we're clearly at odds with some of the people sitting behind us, they may have the answer to some of these. So I would be happy to defer if they might have the answer, or certainly afterwards if it makes sense.
Thank you. Senator Keel.
Thank you. And I guess it's important to me because we do have that, and I agree with you, Senator, vital check of the people, that critical piece that Alaskan voters do get a say. And they serve that critical check on who serves on the bench, just as they elect who serves in the legislature. And I don't have the research, but I'd be a little surprised if anybody had been elected to a 3-year term as Chief Justice without having gone in front of the voters after their first 3 years on the Supreme Court bench. So we really do have I was intrigued by your James Madison quote. That the judges will be a choice, though a remote choice, of the people in the federal sense. And so if you have a judge who has been retained by the people, they've weighed in. They've made that decision. And so that vote on the Judicial Council, though a remote choice, reflects the will of the people. To my way of thinking, I was curious. I have to confess to a weakness in my knowledge of the Constitutional Convention. Who were the consultants? Were they Alaskans? Were they brought in from outside?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. We're asking too many questions, and my brain is full. I was hoping if I could go back and answer the first one or two, and then we'll circle back around, if that's okay. The first one, and I'll try to get to the first two if I remember them right there, Senator Keel, through the chair, the point that you drew out, that the remote choice of the people, even though it be remote, the point is that there would be some process in there where the people still had a voice in who got selected. The key is some states it happens, some states it does not. Ours does not, and I think this is the differentiator. Where you would be directly elected, okay. But in our case, there is no direct line from the people to the three members that sit on that council. No direct line whatsoever. And those three, and then the Supreme Court Justice being the fourth, and the cases that we know have already happened, where there's been a split decision between the non-attorney people, also offices of the state, and the bar or the Judicial Council members, when they make those choices and the Supreme Court judge sides with them, they've made the decision for who's going to go to the governor. And in that process, in a state like ours, how it is set up, there is no voice of the people. that voice comes strictly from bar members, from that very small subset, 0.6% or so of the population, makes that decision. And I think that's the distinction I'm driving at between that remote choice of the people. If they had a more direct, would maybe be a little more than a remote choice. But in this particular case, there's essentially no choice, with the exception of the argument that, well, there's three civilian members that are, you know, per article, and I forget which one, I have to look at which section of our Constitution in the state that says those three, and quasi-judiciary, et cetera, will be a point, you know, have a legislative up and down vote. But when you go back to that, the other four, in essence, have not. So that's the one I think that is most concerning, because you have essentially half of the council that is picking the future members of our bench with no voice from the people, only a very small subset. And that's, I want to get to those first two points that you made, and I know there was a third, and I apologize. I just had to stop it. I should have been writing them down.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's interesting. I guess my point that the Chief Justice is retained, and so the people have weighed in. So 57%, 60% basically of the council members do have that line to the people. But the next question then was the consultants that you cited to in the Constitutional Convention, were they Alaskans, or who were those consultants?
I'm going to defer to my lifeline.
Mr. Ogun.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, through the Chair, Senator Keel. I don't know exactly who the consultants were. The reference for that that quote is the Vic Fisher book. The consultants, after they gave the memo that I quoted, the book says, the consultant, if I may read, the consultant suggested the number of revisions that would, in their view, democratize the proposed system by providing for legislative confirmation of the attorney members of the Judicial Council, adding a Superior Court judge and another lay member to the membership of the council, and other changes. However, the suggestions were not accepted by the meeting of the committee chairman and never reached the convention floor. So it was clearly discussed before, during the meeting. But I don't know who they were and what their qualifications were, but I have to assume if they're advising the Judiciary Committee, they were, and hired by the convention, they were, somebody considered them qualified.
Okay. I just want to tag a question if we're going to research, because it's very much related, if that's okay. And I'm guessing you don't know this, but I'd like you to get back with us. How many attorneys were involved with drafting the Constitution, whether they were consultants or whether they were some that were in the working groups, the committees, and among the signers? The whole ball of wax, how many were attorneys?
Madam Chair, we'll try to get that answer. I'm reading as fast as I can through a rather thick section of the constitutional minutes, the convention itself. I'm just not fast enough to get it all out. So,
and that might be a good question for our legislative librarian, by the way. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there was a reference to a series of split votes between the attorney members and the public members in a specific time period. Two more sort of historical questions that probably would call for some research. In the time period of those five split votes, that year and a half, a little less, how many total votes were there? And then what's that look like over a longer time period? What's that look like, the split votes versus the total votes, going back, I don't know, maybe not till stated, maybe 25, 30 years, I don't know, a longer period. Let's take a look at, I would be interested to see, again, sort of whether this is a system that's got a consistent problem, or whether there are a few outliers and we've just got a statistical set of coin flips where, I'll be darned, it's head four times in a row. Well, it happens, you know. So that would be, I think, valuable for me to see as I look at the issue.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, we'll get that data. We'll see what's available and how far back we can look. I have no idea how far back it goes, but we'll find what we can get available, and we'll get it to the, I guess, the whole committee, if Madam Chair would prefer, to be distributed.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Another thing that is interesting to note is that judges are sworn to uphold our Constitution, correct? And in our Constitution, it talks about the powers derived from the people. And yet we seem to get people weighing in against this as far as empowering the people in this way. So I find that pretty fascinating. And I did mean to note for the record that Senator Michicki joined us quite a number of minutes ago, maybe 10 minutes ago, would you estimate, something like that. So do you have any questions, Senator Michicki, or comments?
Madam Chair, just a comment to yours. I think this is fascinating what you brought up, but as I mentioned before in my military analogy, the closer you get to somebody's empire or their headquarters, and often the harder they fight. And I'm not saying that's what's really at play here with the Judicial Council, but my point is if I am getting to something that maybe is upsetting people and they think it's fine or they don't think it needs to be fixed, et cetera, it's a sensitive area. And clearly that's happening here. And so far, the opposition I've been reading, but not 100% of it, as far as my ability to get through it all with everything else we're doing, is mostly from, as I commented before, strangely, bar, association members, lawyers, et cetera. I have not seen a great outcry from the people on this. I would be surprised if I would. My guess is, if I was to take this to a popular poll and ask the people if they thought they should have a voice and who gets selected to sit on the bench of all of our courts, that they would want to have a voice in that process. And if you were able to get that out in front of the people and educate them, that in fact it's the Bar Association that really in the end has the four of the three that really get to make those picks that go to the governor, my guess is you probably wouldn't find that much public support. It's only a guess, but as I said, I think it's important to note where the opposition is coming from, and often you got to follow that trail, and I think that would give us some interesting data.
And just to clarify, this isn't about giving the people a direct vote on who sits on the bench.
Correct.
This is through the legislature confirmation for the group that selects those that would be put forward. And again, to mention, the people that would be put forward would always be of high merit, so we're not destroying that merit system. Senator Michicki.
So I was just wondering if we're, and I don't have this can be taken as a personal vendetta against the courts, and I just don't have one. They have a tough job. We have a tough job. We're supposed to be isolated bodies, relatively speaking. They sort of get to judge our work and define whether or not what we do is constitutional on a regular basis. We often don't get to do the same with their work. However, we did just remove a judge. The people of Alaska did with a direct vote. They chose to not retain a judge over a specific case. Just wondering if we're getting truly popular on our approach, and I don't mean that that's the reason for dropping this bill, but why not have them be elected by the people? If we want to get that pure on everything that we do here, because I'm seeing more and more and more of that. We have a tendency to want to send everything to the people. And I think the reason this has been primarily run by those in the legal industry is because they're the experts in this field. And I think the reason we make good decisions generally in the legislature is because we are forced to become experts in a lot of the decisions we make. So I'm not playing devil's advocate. I'm not taking an adversary position on this bill. But how much do you send to the people? That's not the kind of government we have.
Madam Chair, through the Chair, Senator Michicki, good question. And you don't have to be adversarial because I'm going to get plenty of that already sitting behind me. So I'm not worried about it. I can feel the heat. And I'll be entirely frank. This is not something I came into the legislature last year going, well, I can't wait to solve this problem. It wasn't even really on my radar. It's something that's come up in discussions. And as we identified it, thought about it, debated it, struggled whether we would even try to do anything with it, it kind of came down to that basic principle. And there was a young man in the building here that gave me, this is kind of a pet project of his. And he gave me some research. I'm like, wow, I didn't see that coming. And he showed me what he'd been working on since college. I'm like, that's really interesting. And so it kind of developed out of that, of looking at it and going, hmm. And matter of fact, I'll go even further. My personal time in front of a court, because I could say I have no personal anything, was once right after 9/11 in Las Vegas. I was still in the Air Force flying F-15s. Somehow I left some wood in the back of my truck. And it sounds silly, but the wood was sticking over the sidewalk, and I had no idea to get a ticket for that. So I got a ticket for it. I'm like, okay, I got to go in front of a judge. This is the only time I've ever had to go in front of a judge, even talk to one that I knew. And I walked into my flight suits. Like I said, it was shortly after 9/11. And he looks, I was the first one in because I was in uniform, so they let me go in front of like 300 people. My name was S. I'm like, whoa, this is going to be a long time shower at the end of the train. And he takes my piece of paper, and the public defender goes, hey, judge, this is what he did. He parked it. He looks right at me and goes, Major, you're going to park your truck on my roads again? I'm like, no, sir. He's like, done. And out the door I went. Nobody could be happier with the court system than me and the judges I've dealt with so far. So this truly is not personal, but I hear what you're saying. I don't think that part of the system, Senator Machicki, you're talking about is broken, and I don't know that it's better or worse to have a system like this appointed by the governor through the process than it is to have elections. They do get elected after that, and they stay or they go based on, hopefully, merit and performance. But I go back to, this is a little different than just the will of the people and pushing everything to them, because our job is to be those experts, as you talked about, the elected representatives of the people. But we're back to the third branch of government that has so much power, some of which you alluded to, doesn't get cross-checked. It doesn't have a check and balance by the people. The people get no voice in who selects them, only a very small subset. I had the numbers out before you came in, of the population gets the chance to talk about who they are. I would not personally propose that we would go to an elective system for the judges their first time out. And I would not propose that the legislature gets to actually pick the nominees for the court. I think that would be, you know, probably too much, and we're not the experts on that system either. I think it's very reasonable, because we're always talking reasonable in court, right? What's the reasonable person believe? Very reasonable that the members of the judicial council that get to pick who goes on the bench have the representatives of the people get a chance to give them an up or down vote. And we do that for just about everything else except those three people.
Senator Machicki.
Yeah, we do have a specific reason why the courts are independent, or it would be a mob rule on every decision, mm-hmm. right? And mob rule is just not always the right one. And I'm going to say mob because we see it sometimes. I guess I wish I would have been here for the rest. I will review the discussion that occurred. The five attorney split votes means nothing to me, even though they went the one way. I'd like to understand the problem, and I respect your opinion. We are very aligned on a lot of things, and I've been very frustrated with the courts, not only locally but to the Supreme Court level sometimes, because by golly, they don't always agree with me, and I like it when people agree with me. But I'll spend more time on this and review the hearing. I'm sorry I missed it. We were in finance, which you would have been as well. But that's it, Madam Chair. I just have more to learn.
Okay. Senator Schauer?
Matt, through the chair, Senator Machicki, appreciate that. And I want to make it clear again for the record, there's no vendetta I have here. I'm not out for the courts. I don't have anything like that. This was really a matter that was brought to me, not the other way around. This is not trying to change the court system or what we have in place. I think we've advocated tried to make it very clear. We think that most of it works just fine, and that's not an issue of how the court system is working or even the merit based and how you would elect them. Only that in this process, as we've looked at it from the founding fathers to today throughout history, there's almost like a little gap in there we missed when we did this. And you go back to our constitutional convention as a state, and that was, I think you did miss that part of the conversation where we had the five and two, the seven consultants, and it was mostly lawyers, five of the two. And so we can go back and I can discuss afterwards if you'd like, but that was what was interesting, is that instead of going the way other states, we went this way, and the Bar Association essentially gets to make those choices. So that's what I think we're after here, is that small gap that we're missing, that perhaps we have taken that Republican form of government away from the people on that very important and independent third branch of government, and we do not allow the people to have a say in who goes there, but we certainly do on every other position in our government, both federal and state, of the level we're talking about. I believe Mr. Ogan might have had a comment, if I might defer, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Through the chair, I just wanted to close with this. Judges and courts have a lot of power over our lives. They can imprison us, they can impoverish us, and they can overturn laws that the legislature passes. And I think it's imperative to, I've served in this building for 10 years in both the House and the Senate, and I'm back as staff support to Senator Schauer. In my experience, I served with 8 years of my 10 years in a Democratic, the Democrat governor, for Governor Knowles. And we never, I don't think anybody was ever turned down. I can't recall who all we turned down. I think we turned down a couple, but they weren't necessarily turned down because of politics. I don't think that's ever been a case. You know, the questions I would like to ask if I was sitting in your chair of the members of Judicial Council is probably the number one question. Would you make sure that you appoint people that are fair and balanced and aren't going to legislate from the bench? That's the one thing, the one litmus test I'd put to them. Not how you vote, what you think about social issues, things like that. I just want, and I've spent a lot of time, 10 years in the administration. My primary job is I managed a team of people that litigated cases both in federal court and state court. And the first thing we did when we got a case assigned, we're like, who's the judge? Okay, what do you know about him? How are they conservative? Are they liberal? What are the history of the rulings? You want to look, and that's the first thing any good lawyer does. And they want to figure out if they've got a fair and impartial judge. And I think that's the litmus test that the Bar Association obviously wants. And I think that's a common denominator that the legislature wants. And if I thought that this was going to turn into a political circus, I would not be supporting this. And the Constitution does not allow it to become that, because it's very expressly says we cannot consider the bar can't consider a member of the Judicial Council what their politics are, and the legislature would be constitutionally prohibited from doing the same.
Okay, thank you. Senator Keel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I would actually be interested to hear, I think there have been a couple references to folks from court or from the Judicial Council who might want to talk. But just an observation first, I guess, when I think about the other situations, I'm not sure that this one did get missed by the convention, Constitutional Convention founders, that by and large, and I'd love your responses, by and large, they required two branches of government to make a decision. So you think about a regulatory board, the governor appoints, the legislature confirms, then they can set a regulation, they can set a fee, Regents of the university, same deal, governor appoints, legislature confirms. This seems to be the only situation where there's two and a half, right? It's about half the members, governor appoints, legislature confirms, then they screen and the governor appoints. So you've got this even more steps and stages, more checks in the process with this particular board than any other. So I'm interested in how would you square that? My read is that this actually has more branches of government involved and more steps accountable to the people rather than fewer. Can you sort of help me with that thought?
Do you want to go first? I can go.
You do a great job, Senator.
I'll go through the chair, Senator Keel. This is the way I see it, and I do think it was missed, so maybe we'll just disagree at the end. When you look at how this was formed, go back to the Constitutional Convention minutes and read them, as you had through those professional consultants and they went through that debate. And I'd have to go back, and let me go back, and I decided to say go back twice. As noted by the professional consultants, these sections in particular go a long way toward withdrawing the judicial branch from the control of the people of the state and placing it under the organized bar. The convention has gone farther than necessary or safe in putting them, the Judicial Council, in the hands of a private professional group, however public-spirited its members may be. I would tell you that in answer to your question, the very people that sat and went through this conversation would disagree with your contention that somehow there is more control. The very people that were involved in the process said there is less. We are removing the people's voice from the selection of who ends up being on the bench and wielding immense power from the bench. So that would be my answer to your question. I hope I answered it correctly. I may not have based on that look. Or you have something else.
And I'd just like to say I would do the math a little bit differently, because the bar is not part of the legislative branch. It's not part of the executive branch. So when I do the math, I don't get 2.5. I get 1.5, because the governor is is doing the appointment, but the legislature only gets to approve half. So my math is a little bit different. Mr. Ogun, did you have anything else you wanted to add to that?
No, ma'am.
Senator Keel?
But just if you've got a governor appointment, a legislative confirmation of some, people vote on the justice, it's in the judicial branch, it screens for the governor, so we've got all three branches involved at some level. Just my last comment, and then I'll leave off and hear from other folks, but I really am intrigued to hear more about these consultants, because it was the convention delegates who were elected by the people who disagreed with them. So that's why I'm really keen to dig into that one.
And Senator Keel, apples to apples, oranges to oranges. So your example earlier was Board of Regents, I believe, and I can't remember the other one. So we're simply talking about the appointment process, not all the other ramifications and how it all works together as far as the judiciary branch and the legislative branch, simply the appointments. Senator Michiki, do you have anything else?
Madam Chair, maybe a response. I think Scott would like to answer a little bit of that.
Just one point I'd like to make for the record is that if memory serves me, there's been very, very, very few judges that have actually been turned out by election. We just did one here recently. In my recent memory, there's been one other since I've lived in Alaska, which has been over 40 years. So and I don't recall, don't know about before that, but compared to how many people get turned out of this building that are elected officials, it's minuscule. I make a habit of voting no on every judge unless I know for sure that it's a judge I like, and I know a lot of other people that do the same, and I do that because if there is somebody that's getting on a radar screen, it's the voters are not real enamored with it. Maybe they have a chance of actually getting them removed, and it's not to be vindictive. I just think it's good to get a little fresh blood in every once in a while. It's a pretty limited check, and it's rarely, if ever, used. So the other way to get rid of a judge, of course, is through an impeachment process, and that would originate in this body. But we're not really talking about any of that here. I mean, we're talking about a very, very small little correction to just have a little – know who's – be nice to know who's picking our judges, know their background, and see if they have any red flags in their background. I don't think that's an onerous thing.
Madam Chair, we owe you answers, though, for Senator Keel, and we will get them regarding the conventional Constitution minutes.
Okay. Senator Michiki.
So the where I want to put more thought, and again, I we've all been swamped, right? I mean, we just are. The place I want to put more thought is there a reason why those three positions are independent? Mr. Ogun, I appreciate your statement about us not being overly political on the people that we confirm, but that just simply isn't the case. We dig stuff up from elementary school, and we parade it out there as though the rest of us should be casting the first stone. I'm other than our chair here, I know no one else in this building is perfect. And we can use it. We can use those, and the senator presenting the bill, perhaps, and perhaps Senator Keel. Well,
no,
maybe not.
No,
I, but you know what I mean. It's not an apolitical. There's nothing apolitical about it. And the prime example is the Board of Fish, and we can go off on other things as well. But that's not what happens here. And I just wonder if something was meant to be truly scrubbed of all politicism, and that's the only thing I want to put more time into. This sounds like a change that I would support.
I'm sure,
but I just want to put more time into trying to understand if there was a reason for those three positions to be independently selected by sort of the technical experts, as opposed to those that are going to be gauging or weighing in politically.
And before Senator Schauer, maybe the politicizing, we need a better definition, because if I'm digging to see what someone did in grade school or their a background check, I don't consider that political. I consider that's part of the qualification and the merit check. So, Senator Schauer, did you have a
– Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Senator Michiki, I think that going back, the important thing here for your I guess your point out of that is that what I am concerned about is, excuse me, when you go to the base, it is, when you look at the Constitutional Convention minutes, which you can read that, and we'll get a more vetted answer, a thorough answer to provide you with this, is that we are looking for a way to, and I could agree with you if there was a bigger subset that had a part of the selection. But when you, which again, you missed the kind of the intro on the Federalist Papers and the design of the Republic and how the people would have a voice in that Republic, that Republican form of government. And we're down to a 0.6% of the population that gets to pick, in essence, who goes on one of our three branches of government, a third of government. And that's really where the crux of this is, to answer your question about, as you want to look further at that, that's really kind of is what we were focused on. And so if it was a broader subsection, which I would argue this change does, because then it allows all of the people through their elected representatives to have a chance to look at who those judicial council members would be, then you've opened up that aperture, so it's not just 0.6% of the population deciding, essentially, if you had four, you know, attorneys or judges that would make that decision, you'd have those three plus the Supreme Court. That's troubling to me because then they could sway it any way they choose. They could take it every single time. And there's been no cross-check on their selection other than that 4,500-member bar association out of 750,000 Alaskans. That, I think, is what troubled me the most, that really got me to launch into this. I'm like, how can we make that better? How can we see if there's a way to make sure more of the people have a voice and who goes in such an important part of the government, one of three full branches? So that's it, and we'll provide more answers, but I think that's very important and germane because he missed part of the earlier discussion. I want to kind of get that back for him, the same concerns. That's kind of what got me here. So,
okay, we do want to wrap this up, so because I still want to bring Ms. Mead and Mr. DiPietro up.
Super quick.
Go ahead.
I said three. I meant five. Attorneys, and I think this is the second or third time we've seen this bill since I've been here. This is my seventh year, so three sessions, very similar approach. Mm-hmm. And it's just funny in this discussion because there are very conservative people that were not in favor, and there are some fairly liberal folks that were. It's just one of those strange causes. And I don't remember some of those arguments because I think the last one was 3 years ago. But it's just one of those interesting approaches that I'm going to be very careful in how I look at it, but I'll keep an open mind. I know what you're trying to do, and I think it's honorable.
And I'll just mention, I believe that the last one was actually adding three public members that would have tipped the scales. And to me, this is a much smaller tweak, much more reasonable. And so I'm happy that we've been able to hear the bill. I want to thank you. I want to bring up Ms. Mead and Ms. DiPietro, if you wouldn't mind coming up at the same time, just to save some time. Just so folks will know, and so the sponsor knows, we will be bringing this bill back up on Monday, so you have a chance to respond to anything that they might say, and we'll also be holding public testimony. Thank you. Ms. DiPietro, would you like to go first and put your name on your record and just give your thoughts on SJR 3, or would you prefer Ms. Mead go first?
Madam Chair, I would prefer to go second, if that would be okay.
Okay. Thank Ms. Mead, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity. As you recognize, this is a resolution that the Alaska Supreme Court has asked me to oppose. The reason that the court system is opposing this resolution is because the court system believes that it's not a harmless change to the Constitution to add this legislative confirmation, and in fact that it has the potential to be quite harmful to judicial independence, and it goes to the administration of justice, and that is the reason that we are taking a position against this. And the reason that the court doesn't believe that it's a harmless change is, as you discussed, confirmation, it depends on your definition, and I have no intent whatsoever to disparage anybody's intentions in the legislature, but confirmation of appointees often does become something other than 100% merit-based. Right now, those appointees by the Bar Association to the council are appointed based on merit, and to be frank, not a lot of people apply for these jobs. These are not plum positions that are highly competitive with, you know, 12 or 15 people that we're voting on. Ms. DiPietro has more information on this, but often there's one, two, or three people, attorneys, who are going for these slots. Those attorneys, should they go through legislative confirmation, would run the risk of having, for example, as somebody said, you look for red flags. Those red flags might be things they said in a brief when they were representing somebody in court. They might be donations they may have made to politicians in the past. I imagine your staffers, who are very thorough with all sorts of confirmations, will look at APOC filings, and we'll look at things that are not something that bar members look at when we vote for attorneys to be on the council. As an example, you can look at the Attorney General appointee and how he was he needed to defend against things he said during litigation and separate himself from that and explain how those comments made in litigation do not necessarily represent character, beliefs, or something like that. And so the implication that this is just harmless is not something that I guess I would agree with. And I think I don't even really have to make that point, because the sponsor himself and the sponsor staff acknowledge that part of the goal, the very goal of this, is to change the nature of who's on the bench. And there are comments in the sponsor statement about criminal justice and hang 'em high judges, and the implication that perhaps the judges, some judges, are perceived as being not tough enough in sentencing criminal defendants, for example. And I think that that is really the goal, is to get behind who's on the bench. And the thinking is that if there's a little bit more of a check on who chooses the nominees that go to the governor, then it might change the nature of the judges. And so that's why it goes beyond a harmless, just like every other board and commission, legislative confirmation. And I would point out, this isn't just like every other board and commission. This is an independent entity created in the Constitution. The Board of Fish isn't in the Constitution, and the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers isn't in the Constitution. This is set up specifically as an independent group. It's in the judiciary article on purpose to read this way. And I will back up just a little bit to 1959, when the constitutional drafters discussed this provision. And I provided, and I hope you have, my excerpt from the minutes of the Constitutional Convention. And this is not, as was stated in the sponsor statement, a stark, glaring oversight. This was an absolutely purposeful, well thought out, debated provision. There was an amendment during the Constitutional Convention to provide for legislative confirmation of the three attorney members. That was discussed, and this is my document that I provided to the committee. On the top, it says excerpted minutes, and I see you're receiving it. It's also on basis, is my understanding. But this describes this whole theory of the Missouri plan. And what it says, and I'm reading a sentence right now from the bottom, so I'm going to go a little bit out of order, but on the bottom of that first page, and these are actually quotes from the debate when they discussed this very issue. The theory on the lay members on the confirmation, they represent the public. They represent the predominant political thought. That's 50% of the members on the commission, three of them. The theory on the lawyer members of the council, they represent the profession. They represent the best interests of the profession. They represent a desire to have the best judges on the benches. And so again, this wasn't accidental. The other thing they said is the whole theory of this Missouri plan was that, in substance, a select and professional group licensed by the state can best determine the qualifications of their brothers. Now, that isn't giving lawyers any elitist or special or this tiny piece of the population a say that seems unfounded. It's just the same as acknowledging that when you need heart surgery, you might ask other doctors who's the best heart surgeon in town. And it doesn't mean that you put it to a popular vote or you consider other things. You go to the people who know their brethren, as they said back in the day, because I think these were all men, and they are best able to tell you who is the person who should be at the top of their field. And it goes on to say, the vote of the professional men, sorry, it says men, who knew the foibles, the defects, and qualifications of their brothers. It is unquestionably true that in every trade and profession, the men who know their brother careerists the best are the men engaged in the same type of occupation. So it wasn't an accident. It isn't willy-nilly that lawyers get to choose the three lawyers on the commission. It's very purposeful. And the minutes go on. I'm just going to read a couple more things, Madam Chair. If you require confirmation of your attorney members, so this isn't a generalized discussion of the judiciary article, which is what the consultants were talking about. This is this very, very idea. If you require confirmation of your attorney members, you can promptly see what will happen. The selection is not then made by the organized bar on the basis of a man's professional qualifications alone. The determination of the selection of those people who are on the council will be qualified by the condition. And we absolutely agree with this. Are they acceptable to a House and a Senate or a Senate alone, which is essentially a Democratic or essentially Republican? No longer is the question based solely on the qualification of the candidate for the bench. These thoughts from 1959 are exactly the thoughts that we have now. This system has worked well for the last 50 plus years, and maybe it's 60, and there is no need to think that that thinking, which swayed the day back then, is any different now. As it goes on to say, the question will be, are they acceptable in terms of political correctness? We do not want that question coming into play until the very end of the judicial selection process. I will just finish with the Constitutional Convention minutes to say, if you flip to the last page, you'll see that that amendment failed. And it was overwhelming. 49 people said, no, we do not want legislative confirmation of the attorney members, compared to 4 who did. So it wasn't an accident, and it was not a stark oversight. It was absolutely purposeful. And as I say, those concerns hold sway just as well today. We do not want the qualifications to go out the window. We actually don't want the merit base to be de-emphasized at all and add politics at that level. I also want to touch a little bit on the votes and why it's not necessary to change what is actually what has been working very well. The Alaska constitutional drafters had the benefit of 49 other state constitutions to look at, and they had the benefit of seeing what was working well and what was not working well. There are at least 12 other states that do not require legislative confirmation of their attorney members. We are not a lone wolf in this area. They studied the other states, and we have what is known countrywide as the gold standard in selection of judges. There is a balance. There are 3 people appointed by the governor and confirmed by the legislature. That is the people's voice. There are 3 lawyers, and by the way, those lawyers are your constituents and they're people too. They are not judges. They are regular Alaskans and citizens. So all 6 of those people on the council are constituents. They're regular Alaskans. The Chief Justice votes only rarely when there's a tie. And this is something that I wanted to focus on, too. I gave you all a half sheet kind of that says Judicial Council voting history. That's on basis as well. And what this shows is that this is a council that works very, very well. Since 1984, which is as far back as the data goes, there have been 1,389 votes. 82.5% of them were either unanimous or 5-1. That is a highly functioning, well-functioning organization. I doubt you can say that about many other organizations in this state. During that whole period, the Chief Justice had to vote 75 times. So 5% of the votes were tied. Now that's 5% of all the votes that had any tied. Out of those 75, the Chief voted yes to go ahead and send the name to the governor 57 of those times. So most of the time when it's tied, the name goes to the governor to let the governor make the decision. And by the way, those 75 times, are all the ties. So most ties are a couple attorneys and a couple non-attorney, or the other way around. Only 19 times, so we're talking 1% of all the votes since 1984, had an attorney and non-attorney split. Again, that doesn't show a dysfunctional organization or an organization where the attorneys are bullying the public members. This is a group that gets along and cooperates well. And out of that, those times when the Chief Justice had to vote, 8 times they voted with the non-attorneys and 11 times with the attorneys. Now, that is an inconsequential difference. There cannot be any conclusion that the chief votes with the attorneys every time. It's just not borne out by the data. So the data shows a lot of things, but it doesn't show an organization that has problems and needs to be adjusted. So I would be happy to talk more about the votes and how the council works, but I will hurry up a little bit because I sense that I should. I want to hit something on the head that is a little bit difficult, but I do think that it's fair to say that there's a thought that the judiciary, that this sort of change to something about the Judicial Council and how judges are chosen is needed because there's a sense that our judges are not conservative enough. There's a sense that the judges are overempowered or exercising judicial activism from the bench. Our Constitution is like every other constitution in every other state, and the federal constitution does have checks and balances. One of the main checks and balances for the legislature is that you can, in every single solitary session I've been here, you have overruled an opinion of the court by changing the statute. You will say in your legislative intent, the whole purpose of this is to change the decision of the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals. You can do that. You can do that all the way up to the point where it's a constitutional determination. In our system of government, somebody has to have the last say on what is or isn't constitutional, and it is the Supreme Court. That sometimes frustrates the legislature because you pass something that you believe is constitutional and the Supreme Court decides otherwise. Somebody has to have that last say. But if the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals says our interpretation of this statute is X, you, the next session, very often do pass a statute to say that we don't think is good policy, we're going to make it Y. And that happens all the time. So that is a big check that you have on the opinions that come out of the court system. And then I also want to say that there's a sense that conservatives can't become judges. And I think that might be driving a little bit of this from what I understand. But I want to tell you that people come from all sorts of backgrounds. Our judges, we have 73 judges. About 42% of them were prosecutors. About 33% were public defenders. And I just mean any time in their past history. They have all different sorts of training. They've been business attorneys, public interest attorneys, and I don't think it's an appropriate thing to say that that it's hard for certain people to get through the council because of their politics. We have judges who went to military schools, Christian schools, public universities, private universities. They fish, they fly, they're in Boy Scouts, they're in church, they do athletics. So there isn't this unified liberal bench that sometimes I think there is a myth about. And to the extent people think there is, I just say if you can point to something that makes you think so, we might be able to talk about it. But to the extent that there's a sense that is being repeated, I think that is hard to discuss without hard evidence about that. So with that, I will be happy to take questions. Actually, I have one more thing I want to say. Our judges are ranked during the retention cycle by all the jurors who appear in front of them. And they get a score, and this goes out to the public. The score for our judges in performance, and the categories they're ranked in, is impartiality, fairness, integrity, temperament, diligence, and overall. It's on a 5-point scale, and they're ranked 4.9. 4.9, which I would think is really, you'd be hard-pressed to do any better than that in any organization. So these are your constituents who sit in front of those judges for days or hours and see how things are going. And the peace and probation officers rank the judges as well. And their overall ranking of judges, peace and probation officers, is 4.5 out of 5. So we don't have a broken system. We don't have something that I think needs fixing. And by the way, that's statewide, including in your district, Madam Chair. And I would be happy to answer any questions.
The data that you provided as far as the split 8 and 11, could you follow up with us as far as the dates of that, of when the years that occurred, so we see if that trend is it's evenly spread across time or whether it's changed in the last decade or so?
I can give you that, Madam Chair. I will say there haven't been any in about the last 4 years. And Ms. DiPietro will correct me, but I think that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Ms. DiPietro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Suzanne DiPietro. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Judicial Council. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to come here and say a little bit about the council's work. I know sometimes people are not aware of the council's procedures, so I was going to just talk briefly about the council's procedures and its purposes and goals. And then I also have a little bit of information about how Alaska's judicial merit judicial selection system fits in with the national picture. So first of all, I want to bring your attention to the council's bylaws, which are posted on its website and also in our published to you every other year in its annual report. So this is what the council, by its bylaws, is looking for when it is evaluating people who want to be judges: professional competence, including written and oral communication skills, integrity, fairness, temperament, judgment, including common sense, legal and life experience, and demonstrated commitment to public and community service. These are the qualities under our bylaws that the council members are all evaluating in the applicants. I want to also bring to your attention that the council has published very detailed selection procedures. They're on our website, and they are published in our biennial report, which we send to you every 2 years. And prohibited considerations for the council in its evaluation of people who want to be judges include the applicant's political or religious beliefs. So it's just those are actually written down prohibited and considerations for the council. The reason I'm bringing this to your attention, it's a little bit tedious, but the council is very proud of the transparency that it uses in its judicial selection process. Our bylaws are available in written form, and they're posted on our website. These very detailed, our selection procedures, there's like 15 pages of detailed procedures about how the council evaluates people who want to be judges, including an extremely important public component of the process. So at any time in a judicial selection process, a citizen can go on our website or look up our address and send us a written letter about any applicant, or to give the council any advice or opinion about how it should be doing its job. And that is always available, and all those communications go to the council members for their consideration. And then even more, and in a formal sense, for every single judicial vacancy, the council holds a public hearing in the community where that judge is to be seated. And the council has been very gratified, particularly in the rural areas, to have, you know, standing room only attendance at those public hearings. And the people come and they tell the council who they think are the good applicants, and sometimes even more interestingly and importantly, tell the council, you know, what are the challenges we have in our community, what are the strengths of our community, so that the council members can take that into consideration when they're trying to decide who is the most qualified, who are among the most qualified applicants. So those are the procedures that the council uses. So I next just want to talk briefly about how the council fits into the national perspective, and I would really welcome the opportunity to maybe have a little dialogue with the sponsor's office on this, because one of the things that staff keeps track of is what's happening on the national scene with judicial selection, and the statement that only a handful of states don't require legislative confirmation of attorney members. I'm not finding that in the data that I have, so I would welcome the dialogue with the sponsor's office on that. In fact, I'm finding, so I've got a tally of about 35, and I can provide this information to the committee. I've got a tally of about 35 states that use a judicial nominating commission in some way. You know, the states are all very different in how they how they do things, the experiment of democracy. But many, 35, use judicial nominating commissions to help select either some or all of their state court judges. So by my tally, in 18 of those, the Bar Association appoints the attorney members of the commission with no further involvement by the governor or the legislature. Now, in a couple of those, there are seats reserved for legislative appointment, and sometimes those can be reserved for lawyers or non-lawyers, or sometimes the legislature can appoint anyone. So it's done a lot of different ways, but it's pretty the idea that the legislature actually has to confirm an attorney member of a judicial nominating commission, I found only two states where that is the case. So that would be a minority in my research, and I would welcome the dialogue. That would be an extreme minority in my research. And there are lots of, and you know, I've got a whole chart here about all the different ways they do things. But I just want to put that out there that the most common template for the judicial nominating commissions is really similar to what the Judicial Council has, where a roughly equal number of attorney and non-attorney members are appointed, usually the attorneys by the bar, with no further involvement of or confirmation of a legislature or a governor, and the attorney members then by a variety, the non-attorney members then by a variety of methods, sometimes gubernatorial appointment and other ways. So my understanding is that the way that the attorney members are appointed to the Judicial Council is actually in Alaska is actually the most common template that we find nationally.
Thank you, Ms. DiPietro. We're short on time, but if you could provide that chart, and I'm wondering if you could also provide for the states what the makeup and the number, how many attorneys versus non-attorneys, because that would make a difference if there are other states where they're not confirming, but maybe it's three attorneys and six non-attorneys. That just makes a difference. So I think that's an important part of the conversation. So I want to thank you both today. We are short on time. Appreciate it. You did definitely bring up some very good points that we need to consider. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
And moving right along, next we are going to consider the governor's appointment to the Commission on Judicial Conduct, Ms. Jane Moores. And before we begin this consideration, I'd like to point out to committee members that asking for an appointee support or advocacy for a specific legislation or policy proposal could be construed as a quid pro quo, and such questions and comments are inappropriate and will not be permitted. And Ms. Moores, as you make your way to the table, and as you do, I'd like to inform committee members that Ms. Moores is my sister. I think you all know that. And because we want the process to be above approach and without even a hint of impropriety, I will now be taking a brief at ease in order to hand the gavel to Senator Machicki, who will preside over the rest of the meeting.
We are back on the record. As mentioned by the chair, we will now consider Ms. Jane Moores and her appointment to the Commission on Judicial Conduct. I don't know where I got that word counsel from. Alaska's Commission on Judicial Conduct was created by amendment to the state constitution in 1968. The commission is composed of three state court judges, three attorneys who have practiced law in the state for at least 10 years, and three members of the public. This group of nine individuals from differing backgrounds and geographical areas address problems of judicial conduct and disability. Complaints alleging judicial misconduct can be filed by any person. Ms. Moores, welcome to Senate Judiciary. Please place your name on the record and tell the committee why you'd like to be appointed to this commission.
Thank you very much, Chair McChicky, and thank you, members of the committee. I have a statement that I'd like to introduce myself to you. I thank you for the opportunity to introduce myself to you as the governor's appointee for the to an attorney seat on the Alaska Commission on Judicial Conduct. A little bit about my personal and professional history first, and then I'd like to talk to you about my service commitment should the legislature confirm my appointment to the commission. My husband, Peter, who is here in the audience, good-looking one in the back, and I are semi-empty nesters with five adult sons slash stepsons between us. Our last two are in college. One here is in his first year at UAS, and one finishing his second year at community college in Oregon. I moved to Alaska from Ohio with my family as a young teenager in 1976. We joined a Christian community about 10 miles outside of Hoonah, known as Game Creek or Mount Bether, where I lived for the next 7.5 years. Navigating those years in a close-knit community taught me a lot about hard work and human nature. I learned life lessons that I will always hold very close to my heart. I don't milk cows, bridle horses, chop wood, can cauliflower, dry greens, dig clams, cheek halibut, pitch hay, hand crank a tractor, or hand weed endless rows of carrots anymore. But that's okay. I like to think that I gained from my years at Game Creek a work ethic, critical thinking skills, and a personal and professional code of conduct that helped define who I am today. In my early 20s, I went from Southeast Alaska to the Southeastern United States, where I obtained my bachelor's degree from Auburn University in secondary education. Having a classmate named Bo Jackson is one of my favorite Auburn stories. And at the last committee hearing I had, there was a question as to who Bo was. Bo was the 1985 Heisman Trophy winner, and we did, in fact, have a class together. After a brief teaching stint in rural Alabama, I obtained my law degree from Ohio State and was admitted to the Alaska Bar in 1990. Since that time, I have represented individuals and business clients, large and small, first with a private firm in Anchorage and then as a sole practitioner in Haines. For the past 12 years, I've been in the public sector. I've had the pleasure of working for the City and Borough of Juneau Law Department. In my years of practice, I've handled tort and contract, insurance defense, business and real estate, employment law, and probate and estate planning matters. I've provided an array of legal services to the CBJ municipal departments and handled a variety of hearings, administrative appeals, and general civil litigation matters. I've advised the Assembly and various municipal boards and commissions such as the Planning Commission, Bartlett Regional Hospital Board, the Bid Review Board, and the Board of Equalization. Through my municipal work, I've conducted specialized board trainings on conflicts of interest and the quasi-judicial role of certain boards, which is that of being a fair and impartial tribunal vested with authority to make decisions under applicable rules of law, much like a judge. Before that, I had the pleasure of serving 6 years on the Alaska Bar Association's Ethics Committee, a committee responsible for researching and writing ethics opinion at the request of Bar Council and or the Board of Governors. This brings me to my interest in serving on the commission and the commitment I make to you as legislators and to every Alaskan should I be confirmed. I believe, and I quote from the preamble of the Alaska Code of Judicial Conduct, "The role of the judiciary is central to American principles, concepts of justice and the rule of law. Judges, individually and collectively, must respect and honor the judicial office as a public trust and strive to enhance and maintain confidence in our legal system. The judge is a highly visible symbol of government under the rule of law. I believe public trust and confidence in our judicial system is essential to the effectiveness of the system. Public trust is not built on blind trust, but it must be earned and maintained through public accountability. We all know that judges have significant authority and make decisions every day that change lives and have far-reaching impacts. Those entrusted with such positions must not only be competent in the law, but must conduct themselves in and out of the courtroom in a manner that upholds the integrity of the office. As you know, the Judicial Conduct Commission is tasked with the oversight of judicial conduct through a fair and impartial deliberative review process that investigates and appropriately addresses complaints of judicial misconduct and disability. This oversight protects the public and maintains public trust. As a member of the legal community, both of these things are especially important to me. I also respect the constitutional makeup of the commission, that of public citizen members, judge members, and attorney members. I can assure you that in carrying out my commission responsibilities, every voice and perspective on the commission will be of equal import to me. I think anyone who knows me would vouch for that fact, and you have my commitment on that. I'm very honored by this appointment from the governor and will undertake my duties to the absolute best of my ability. I also want to acknowledge and give a shout out to Juneau attorney and my colleague, Lael Harrison, for her integrity and professionalism as having been appointed to this seat last year by the prior administration. I want to thank you for your time and consideration, and I also want to thank each of you for your hard work for the people of the state of Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Morse. Do we have any questions for Ms. Morse? Senator Keel.
Mr. Chairman, actually, I don't have a question. I just want to let the members know that I have worked with Ms. Morse professionally for several years when she was deputy city attorney, and I served on the City and Borough of Juneau Assembly. I have worked with her on any number of issues. She, I believe once, in fact, gave me informal ethics advice. She has given advice on a tremendous number of legal questions, including, in one memorable case, advice I did not want that took us in a direction I did not want to go, but she was right. And I'm so glad that she's been appointed to the commission, and just figured I would take the opportunity to give an endorsement on this one.
Thank you. Any comments, Senator?
Well, Senator Mushiki, you brought up earlier something about during the confirmation we could dig back into the elementary years. I could certainly do that, but I am going to spare the appointee. But I'm very proud of her.
Well, I have just a few questions. It looks like Ohio State, Juris Doctor, and then moved back. In 90, you were at Faulkner, Banfield, Dugan, and Holmes. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then did you go outside for a year as a contract attorney for Bogle and Gates? Is that?
That was a season. That was after I was in Haines. And it was a part of a trip. My ex was like to travel, and we were out for the season, and I took a part-time project job with Bogle and Gates that was in Houston, Texas. And so it was a very temporary position on this complex tax litigation, and that was what that was.
And then since then, you've been essentially in municipal law, but clearly well over the 10 years, which is what I was sort of arriving at. So since 1990, you've been practicing in the state of Alaska.
29 years I've been practicing law.
Those are all the questions I have. I also, I guess, should state for the record that I know Ms. Morse and her husband and her either older or younger sister. Apparently I've heard some discussion about that, but I'm pleased to have you here before us as well. Is there any other questions? I'm sure your mother is watching and very proud. I guess what I'll say now is that in accordance with 3905080, the Senate Judiciary Committee reviewed the following and recommends the appointment be forwarded to a joint session for consideration, Commission on Judicial Conduct, Ms. Jane Morse. This does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individuals during further sessions.
Can we take an ease, please?
We're at that part. Take a brief at ease while we... Before?
Before.
Okay. Take a brief at ease.
Are we required...
On record, just in case, we will open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify on Ms. Morse for the Commission on Judicial Conduct? Seeing no one and no one online, we will close public testimony. And then I will restate, I've stated that in accordance with AS 39.05.080, the Senate Judiciary Committee reviewed the following and recommends the appointment be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Commission on Judicial Conduct, Jane Morris. This does not reflect an intent by any members of to vote for or against the confirmation of the individuals during any further sessions. We'll take a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork. 17 p.m.